Welcome to a very special edition of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Gina Columbus. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. But today, we had the pleasure of sitting down with members of Euromigos, a group of genitourinary cancer oncologists from all over the world who share their oncologic insights through their collaborative Twitter account and in the form of their own podcasts. In an effort to share some of the evolving knowledge about COVID-19 and how it is impacting the healthcare system on a global scale, the Euromigos group has discussed statistics, strategies, and new studies as they relate to COVID-19 and patients with cancer. The account is run by Brian Rainey, MD of Vanderbilt Ingram Cancer Center, Thomas Powells, MD, MBBS, MRCP of Barts Cancer Institute, Silke Galesian, MD of the University of Manchester, David F. McDermott, MD of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Christopher Sweeney, MBBS of Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Srikala Sridhar, MD, MSc, FRCPC of Princess Margaret Cancer Center, Laurence Albiges, MD, PhD of Gustave Roussy Institute, and Cristina Suarez Rodriguez, MD of Hospital Coron Barcelona. In today's Onc Live On Air podcast, Drs. Rini, Powells, Sweeney, Galesian, and Albiges came on to chat further about their perspectives on caring for patients with GU cancers and how management has evolved from the early pandemic days to now, as well as looking ahead to the future when we can all eventually return to a state of normalcy. Hello, everyone. We're so happy to have this whole group together today and in collaboration with Onc Live. So how's everybody doing?
Well, thanks, Gina.
Very well. Hanging in there.
Good. That's great. Can I just have everybody quickly just state their names and affiliations?
Hi, I'm Laurence Albiges, a medical oncologist working Gustave Roussy in France.
Hi, I'm Tom Poles. I'm a medical oncologist from Barts Cancer Institute in London.
Hi, I'm Siki Gillison. I'm also a medical oncologist from Switzerland.
I'm Brian Rini, a GU medical oncologist at Vanderbilt.
Hello, I'm Christopher Sweeney, a medical oncologist at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, Massachusetts.
So I think it would be really great to get all of your perspectives on caring for your patients with GU cancers during COVID-19. And how do you think that it has evolved from the early days of the pandemic to what it is now? Would anybody like to start?
I've recently had exposure to both inpatient service and outpatient service of patients with COVID. And three experiences actually cover the gamut. One is a simple scenario, which is a concern to me, is patients are reticent to seek care. And so what we've learned through the pandemic is that we can manage it, we can isolate, and we can really decrease a patient's risk. And for example, a patient on therapy had a dental concern, probably an abscess, and it took a lot of effort to convince him to seek help and an opinion for manager, probably a dental abscess. And if that was let go for a few days, it could have become a bigger problem. So we as physicians need to coach and help patients put those things into perspective. But then on the other extreme is a patient that I received in care. He was from a high-risk area in Boston, was found to be asymptomatic but COVID-19 positive, had a very advanced form of testis cancer, a creatinine of 7, and we had to correct that. Ultimately, he got, I said, well, let's just watch and see how the COVID infection turns out. And it turns out we found out the natural selection of this, natural progress of this. One is that I checked him again later once his renal function had improved as an inpatient, but he actually got symptomatic during that time. So the right thing was to actually hold off on the chemotherapy in the asymptomatic COVID-19 positive patient. So there's a whole spectrum and we have to make value judgments as to which way we go with this particular patient. Sometimes we shouldn't need to push forward, but if they're COVID-19 positive, we may need to pull back and just work their way through that condition first. They're my two recent direct patient anecdote experiences, and I'd love to hear what others have had.
So Chris, maybe I can go in from a Swiss perspective. Obviously, we are a very small country, and we were, in that sense, fortunate because we had these hub hospitals that looked really for the COVID-positive patients and the other hospitals that were kind of COVID-free. But obviously, this is something, you know, you never 100% know. We also had enough tests, so we could test all the patients before they receive the chemotherapy to be, I mean, you're never sure, but at least to have a good hint, even if they were asymptomatic, if they were COVID positive or not. So I think we have learned a lot with that first wave. So we have started to do a lot of telemedicine, like I think in a lot of other countries as well. So I think there are really visits that you can do by phone. And I think this has helped. But as Chris has said, I think it's very important that we give the treatments that are necessary, and that a lot of patients were a bit afraid to come into the hospital. And I think, yes, that is clear. But I guess we can explain that we try to minimize the risk, and it's more important they have their treatment.
Yeah, I would agree. This is Brian. I mean, I would say a month ago, and we did a podcast about a month ago with most people on the phone that, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty, and I think we were all worried about giving regimens that might land somebody in the hospital in the next 2 to 4 weeks. I would say now it's a little different. I mean, in Nashville, we've been pretty flat. I would say steady but flat, not surging. And so I don't personally have that fear anymore. Although obviously I'm still trying to be judicious in terms of what we're giving or the timing of therapy. I will pick up on what Chris said, is that a subset of patients are scared to come to the medical center. We neighbor Kentucky, and the Kentucky governor has basically put the fear of God into people not to come to Nashville because it's a hotbed of COVID, which is completely false. It's just we do more testing. You know, we've done more testing than their state, so it's an incidence issue. But patients don't know any better. They pick up on that, and they get very scared to come, even for a routine blood draw or appropriate care. So a lot of what we're talking about now is how do we allay that fear and have people understand that, you know, they need their medical care and that it's safe to come, and we're doing, you know, believe me, everything possible to make their journey safe here.
And Brian, as a healthcare worker with what turns out to be strep throat, what did you go through to actually be ruled out, ruled in, and managed as a healthcare worker?
Well, I think I've already had COVID. I had symptomatic disease about 4 weeks ago, so that's why I didn't get tested. I just got a strep throat test. But Silky said they're screening asymptomatic patients. We're doing the same before what we call high-risk regimens. Mm-hmm. CAR T cells, transplant, combined chemo, RT, da-da-da, et cetera. We're screening asymptomatic patients. I think we've done about 100 patients. I'm not aware that we've picked up a positive so far. Obviously, what to do with that positive is a more complicated discussion. And guide that patient through the building, so to speak, when they're positive is something we spend a lot of time on. But these are the conversations we're getting into now.
Brian, we had, just because of the numbers, we had 1 out of 45 asymptomatic patients who tested positive.
Okay.
And the guys in Zurich have done a more thorough, like in a study with about 800 people entering the hospital, and they found only 2 or 3, I think, positive patients that were asymptomatic. So it's a very low incidence, as you said.
Yeah,
we've done similar testing. So we've done testing on a weekly basis over the last on asymptomatic healthcare professionals. We feel that a good way of monitoring risk in the hospital is randomly testing healthcare professionals, because clearly if your rates for healthcare professionals, it's a relatively stable body of people, and you can't really control people coming in and out of your hospital. But you can control the safety of your healthcare professionals. And our rates of positivity are well below 1% currently. I mean, they're sort of currently less than 0.1%, but that's probably to do with issues around lockdown more than our hospital being super safe compared to before. And my concern clearly is, as we break this lockdown process, then the infection rates are going to increase. And inevitably, as that occurs, the risk will increase. And keeping patients in, and this is something that our hospital is struggling with at the moment, is how do you remain lockdown sort of social distancing compliant and keep a healthcare system running. Clearly a CT scan is never going to be compliant, giving chemotherapy is never going to be compliant, an outpatient setting is almost impossible to be compliant. And how do we keep the show on the road? Because clearly we're going to have to treat cancer patients. And so what we've decided is we're having, I'm sure you're all the same, we have very rigorous testing in terms of random testing of staff and patients. We're going to make it very difficult to get into the cancer centre. And what I mean by that is that no friends and family, I think patients and their direct carers. And I think there are complex issues about where, if you have in cancer hospitals, if you have COVID positive patients, should they stay there? Should they be moved to other COVID positive areas? And how we manage that. And these are issues which we haven't resolved yet.
Thank you, Tom. So I'm actually happy to share our experience we have. So over the course of the last month, we had around 7,000 patients that were treated, 3,000 patients that were treated. We've screened 1,000, and the positivity rate was 12%, but it was enriched in patients who had symptoms. This is why we have a higher percentage than you mentioned. And we've just presented those data at AACR, but basically out of the first 137 positive patients, what we have identified to be associated with worse form of COVID was a patient with hematological malignancies over solid tumors, patient who had poor performance status, and I think, of course, it does make sense. Those patients may be more likely to have worse outcome. And lastly, and I think it is of interest for all of us, patient who had received chemotherapy in the last 3 months. And when I'm saying chemotherapy, it's because we've looked at the different kind of systemic treatment, including immune checkpoint or TKI. And both of these were not associated with worse outcome, while chemotherapy seem to be associated with worse outcomes. So this is still work ongoing so that we can better fine tune if this could be related to the cancer stage or to the treatment itself. But this is work in progress. And with regard to the strategy we had within the institution, as you did, Tom, we do not allow any family coming. We have clearly increased our remote consultation strategy, with more than half of these being over the phone, and only admitting patients that require, you know, like systemic treatment. We do screen all patients before surgery, and we try to perform that within the last 24 hours before surgery. So it's quite a challenge for any surgical and operating room management. But this is what we do, and we do the same screening for any, let's say, high-dose regimen or chemotherapy that we consider at risk.
Laurence, can I ask you a question about immune therapy? Because I keep getting asked this question. And the UK actually has come up with some nice guidelines suggesting you shouldn't be giving immune combination therapy. We've had 5 or 6 immune patients who have had immune combination therapy who have gone through COVID without any problems at all. I think this is an evidence-free field as it currently stands. And I think I don't understand why we'd be stopping treating patients with treatments that have a survival advantage.
I share the same view as yours. I think we don't have enough data to support cancelling those treatments, and we need to make sure patients receive the treatment in a right setting and secure setting. So for our outpatient clinic, for instance, we have isolated COVID room. And we take patients that have been positive for COVID and make sure they do receive the appropriate treatment, even if they had COVID.
I think, Tom, one thing that we said, you know, is like maybe it is a good idea for these immune therapies to use the longer or the lower frequency schedules. So I think it's just always also a question, how much does the patient have to come in? Because it's not only that we try to make everything safe in the hospital, but some of the patients obviously also have to find a taxi with a taxi driver or even take public transportation and has some risk there. depending on what is the prevalence in the moment of the infection. So we have really tried to use schedules where you don't have to come in that much. I think it's pretty obvious, but still, I think a lot of people don't do it because they're not approved. But we could discuss with the government to change that.
Our FDA just approved Pembro every 6 weeks across all indications, you may be aware. So starting to discuss as a group doing that in bladder and renal for sure.
Yeah, we do the same.
Yeah.
Brian, what's your conversation with the patients that you have about risk and benefit and consent? How's the consent process changed for you? Are you saying that you have a direct risk of COVID and that's increased? And do you try? What's the risk benefit discussion that you have with patients? And what do you write down on the consent forms?
Yeah, so you're talking about not trial patients per se, but just through.
Yeah, just you're coming in for chemotherapy or immune therapy.
Yeah. I mean, what I say is, you know, you are at risk for infection because you have cancer because you're getting treatment, right? That's a true statement. Now the infectious risk includes COVID, which is probably increased by the cancer. I think we would agree on that. How it's increased by treatment, I don't think we know yet. I think it probably is for some treatments, not others. But as you say, the data is incomplete. But I just sort of put it out there, you know, and talk about strategies to mitigate that risk, which might be deferring the start of therapy. And then I do write it in the note that I talked to the patient about COVID risk and we made a decision to start treatment or defer treatment. So I just document it.
I think it comes down to the type of treatment. So I think very high risk, high dose chemotherapy, chemotherapy for heme malignancies, moderate risk, regular chemotherapy, probably the immune therapies are probably mild risk and the hormonal therapies are low risk. So I think we could risk stratify. And on a day-to-day experience, what I've just said to patients is that, yes, we really do need to start this chemotherapy. There is a risk. And just be very upfront that they may end up on a ventilator from it, or they may not be able to access ventilator support if ever the crisis triaging came in effect. And they were actually very open to one and recognizing and understanding of all of that. So I think most patients have a good grasp on the risks, and they are doing the risk benefit management with us. However, just going back to the conversation of maybe how getting everyone on board. So my experience with running a global investigator sponsored trial with the ANZUP group, where we reached out to every region, and these were hormonal therapy based studies. Two patterns emerged. Some people were very, very concerned, and they were saying, we don't want to see patients in a hospital for the next 6 months, so we're not going to do their regular screening and their PSA testing at all. And we had to sort of walk some of the physicians and practices through that, saying, with all the screening and everything like that, it's probably more dangerous not to follow a patient for their cancer than to have them have a slight risk of exposure with all the precautions. So I think it's not just the patients we need to be working on, it's the practitioners. And just some numbers for talking about symptomatic and asymptomatic rates. So of the 20% of patients presenting across our Brigham Women's and Partners Healthcare System, multiple hospitals, 20% of symptomatic patients were COVID positive. And 10% of those with healthcare workers who were COVID positive, so had symptoms, were COVID positive. So, and these are patients with mild symptoms. What we learned is that following some patients, some people do go from mildly symptomatic to very symptomatic, and others they clear it. So what I've learned and working with the infectious disease is to follow patients and just see which, let them declare themselves before launching into treatment if you can.
I'd like to quickly kind of just jump in and ask about clinical trials. So kind of a two-part question, you know, what have you noticed in terms of clinical trial access during all of this? But then also, are there some COVID-related trials that you're all very interested in and maybe as they relate to patients with cancer?
It's a big topic, I guess. You know, we at Vanderbilt, we, you know, shut down new accrual to trials for about a month from late March to basically this week. We're starting to screen and start to accrue next week. And I think that was about uncertainty for where we were headed. I think we have more certainty now. It was also just a human resource question. I mean, we didn't know if half the oncologists would be in intensive care on ventilators, or if half the oncologists were going to get sick and not be able to take care of patients. So thank God that hasn't happened for us and the patients. So I think we just have more certainty, and we're going to start to gradually reopen
we, and I'm sure all of the folks on the call, are doing a ton of trials in COVID with hydroxychloroquine and remdesivir and you name it, you know, so we're doing convalescent plasma, we're doing all sorts of things. None of ours are geared towards cancer patients. We've started to talk about it, but we haven't really designed a trial. Here we just don't have enough cases, thankfully, to probably do a cancer patient specific trial, but I'd be interested in some of the other more high density areas.
We reopened our trials in London a couple of days ago. We recruited our first patient for the first time since the pandemic. We're going to go very slowly. We've got problems getting monitors to site because of the lockdown. Monitors can't come and monitor, and that's clearly a concern around data quality. So I think trials are going to be challenging until this goes away. Cancer trials are going to be challenging until this goes away. The reality is, if there is an increased risk, and people talk about the risk of cancer patients on systemic therapy with metastatic disease being in the region of somewhere between 25 and 35%. If that is the case, and we'll have to wait and see with more mature data, clearly it's going to be difficult finding drugs with moderate benefit because obviously the underlying infection could muddy up the results. I think a lot of what we do in cancer therapy and cancer trials, the cancer trial is clearly the top of the pyramid of the complexity of what we do. And I suspect it's why we've come back online last. And my concern is that it's going to be difficult to collect accurate data if we have waves of infection. And if we do have waves of infection, it's also going to be difficult to keep the patient safe, and we're going to have to keep starting and stopping interventional therapy. So this is a very complex area, and we don't know how it's going to unfold.
I guess it's also a problem with the SAE reporting, because you don't know how reliable it is right now. So also in Switzerland, we have, as Brian has said, we have stopped a lot of the more complex trials for 3 or 4 weeks, and we have restarted this week because here it's very calm right now. So we have very, very low infection rates at the moment.
So what we're doing is that we're screening patients for COVID before taking part into a trial for cancer treatment. And with regard to a COVID trial, we do have a specific cancer patient trial that is more about epidemiology, but also with hydroxychloroquine. And we take part in a randomized TOSI trial as well.
Two things, Brian, to answer your question. One is, we, like you, even though we were in a high density, high infection area, we actually only had 20 patients at any one time at the peak who had cancer in the Dana Farber system and were COVID-19 positive. And then about 200 total, maybe at the total prevalence during the whole peak was maybe about 300, and that's out of thousands of patients. So relatively low. So to do cancer specific for patients with cancer and COVID-19, it was a very difficult undertaking. So all of our patients enrolled in the highly permissive trials for any patients, regardless of their underlying comorbidities.
I think that just about wraps things up. Thank you all for coming in from so many different time zones to share all this insight together. It was really wonderful. I appreciate it. That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this very special episode of Enclave On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews with top KOLs in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave and at EnclaveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at Enclave and Enclave State of the Science Summit, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. To hear more from the Euromigos, you can find them on Apple Podcasts under the Euromigos. If you like today's episode of Enclave On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave On Air.